Zscaler extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines trained by 500 trillion daily signals to prevent ransomware and AI attacks that target business. Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI. Learn more at zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Biden opens up a public dispute with Israel, and especially with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, over the conduct of Israel's war in Gaza. President Biden even says an attempt to clear Hamas out of the city of Rafah, its last stronghold, would be a red line, quote unquote. What's behind this change of rhetoric and perhaps policy toward Israel inside the White House? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with the Potomac Watch podcast here and with my colleagues, Bill McGurn and Kate Batchelder Odell. So, marked change of tone by the president on Israel, notably starting with his State of the Union address, where he lectured the Israeli leaders on how they are conducting the war. Let's listen.
For the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority. As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time.
Well, Bill, well received that line by the Democrats in the House chamber. What do you make of this shift by Biden? And starting with the State of the Union, where he did criticize Hamas for using civilians as shields, but then I think he devoted more time to criticizing Israel.
Yeah, it's a pattern. He gives a general kind of abstract support for Israel. They have right to defend themselves. But all the concrete criticisms, like of their war strategy, all the demands, what they have to do, they're against Israel, not against Hamas. No call, for example, for Hamas to prove its good faith by releasing all the hostages. You know, that's a war crime, holding hostages. And we don't even mention it. So I think he's looking over his shoulder. It might have been well received by Democrats, but the polls show overwhelming U.S. support for Israel. And the criticism is coming from the campuses, the Free Palestine movement, and the Squad, and so forth, all those radical groups. In the editorial today, we suggest we call it the Dearborn strategy after Dearborn, Michigan, where there's a lot of Arab anger at Biden for his policies. And I think that's a real thing. And I think Joe Biden's worried about it. We can see maybe a Democratic convention like Chicago in 1968 with violent anti-war clashes outside with cops while they have a weak candidate fighting for his survival inside. So I do think it's an alarming trend by Biden from initial strong rhetorical support for Israel to now like making more of the arguments made by Israel's enemies.
Kate, the president of the State of the Union also laid out a new initiative going around Israel to deliver aid to Gaza by sea. He's going to have the U.S. Navy set up a floating pier from which ships could deliver aid to Gaza via the Mediterranean. Pretty extensive effort. It's going to involve something like 1,000 U.S. troops, obviously ships, and maybe even have the capacity to deliver a couple of million meals a day. Will take weeks to set up. What do you make of this effort?
Well, so it's just getting started. And to your point, it'll take some time to get set up. The U.S. Army is lending some logistical transport craft to start to build this pier off Gaza. I do think it is a much riskier proposition than is currently appreciated. At a recent Pentagon briefing, I was really blown away when a reporter asked, well, are you concerned at the Pentagon that Hamas will try to fire on those building this pier and getting aid into Gaza? And General Ryder, who's a Pentagon spokesman, said, well, it's a risk, but if Hamas cares about the Palestinian people, I'm paraphrasing, they wouldn't do that. And I think the conclusion from anyone watching is that they don't care about the Palestinian people. So I found this sort of an alarming response, that the risks of this humanitarian mission have perhaps not fully been thought through before executing it.
Well, that's a really interesting point. Of course, the humanitarian concern is real. The suffering by the Palestinian people in Gaza is real and terrible.
and we should all want to do something about it. The problem is that Hamas is the group that doesn't want to do anything about it because the suffering of the Palestinian civilians is the best propaganda weapon it has. And the world is now focused on that. And that's where Hamas wants the world's focus to be. So in that sense, you know, we don't know for sure whether Hamas would even want that kind of aid. I guess it would not rhetorically speak up against it. But on the other hand, if you have American naval personnel and others vulnerable at all there, they could become targets. And the other thing, Kate, you know, I'm just kind of amazed by is there's no focus on Egypt, which is right across the border from Rafah and could allow refugees to flow over, civilian refugees temporarily in camps, get them to safety. Once the war is over, they could go back. But there's no pressure at all on Egypt from the world or the United States to do that.
No, there's been exactly none. And Egypt, of course, has very closely guarded its border and exit out of Gaza and has not faced the same derision that Israel has for making its border difficult to cross while it's in an active war with Hamas. So that is just part of how Israel is treated when it's fighting these wars. But I think I would also question the premise that's out there from the Biden administration, which is that Israel doesn't want to get aid to Gaza. There have been instances of trying to get trucks into Gaza where the scenes descend into chaos. There have been issues of Hamas diverting this aid to try to keep its own war effort running. To your point, the suffering of Palestinians is terrible, and it should require multiple countries working to try to stop it, but it's not as simple as it might look immediately.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the Biden versus Netanyahu dispute over the conduct of the war when we come back.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot here on Potomac Watch, the daily podcast of the Wall Street Journal opinion pages, and I'm here with Kate Batchelder Odell and Bill McGurn. President Biden has been ratcheting up the rhetoric against Israel and the conduct of the war. And on MSNBC on the weekend, he got even tougher. Let's listen.
Would invasion of Rafah, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if he crosses and they cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead as a consequence of going after. There's other ways to deal, to get to deal with the trauma caused by Hamas.
Well, Bill, that was not the clearest explanation of what a red line actually is there. He seemed to be suggesting in the first instance that, well, if you go forward to clear out Hamas from Rafah, which is a city in the south and the last remaining stronghold of Hamas, that if Israel goes to try to clear it out, that that would be a red line and then something would happen if you cross the red line. Of course, he didn't say what. You're not going to cut off military aid to them. So what is he going to do? But notably here, you know, when people talk about red lines, presidents, it's usually about adversaries. Don't do that. It's rarely that you say, in fact, I can't remember an instance where you say to an ally, oh boy, you better not do that or else.
Right. I can't think of an incident either. I think it's unwise to draw red lines. You don't know the circumstances with which something's going to happen in the future. So you don't want to handcuff yourself in. I think privately, you can tell groups not to do something. And if they do, speak softly and carry a big stick, punish them by doing something about it. So it's very confusing. It goes back to what you were saying. Hamas had two strategies. One was killing 1,200 innocent Israelis, including grandmothers and grandfathers, children, couples, and so forth, and just slaughtering these innocents in very brutal ways. But the other half is what you were suggesting before, They want the killing of innocent Palestinians, of civilians. That's why they're in the tunnels and the civilians are on top, helpless. And they've kept on doing it. They don't care because they recognize, as you suggested, that the death of Palestinians is a big win for them. And it makes people much more sympathetic to their cause than if they were just stuck on October 7th, their actions. So I think it's a deliberate strategy. And if President Biden had just devoted like a paragraph to saying that this is a deliberate strategy, we want civilians protected, but Hamas has to recognize its obligations and stop using them as shields and so forth, and that they're doing this as part of a strategy, put all the demands on Hamas, saying that you can't expect Israel to care more about Palestinians than Palestinians themselves. If he had just devoted a paragraph to that, admitting the problem in the main is Hamas and its willingness and eagerness to see dead Palestinians, I think he would have more credibility with Netanyahu about other things he wants.
Yeah, there's a particular focus here on Netanyahu as well, the prime minister, because Netanyahu, of course, is, at least on the American left, has become something of a double figure and is seen as some kind of unreasonable leader. On the other hand, he is the prime minister, okay? You know, he was elected by the coalition and is now the war leader. So whatever you think of him, he is representing the Israeli people. And the administration's policy or rhetorical policy here seems to be to separate Netanyahu from everyone else. And let's get Netanyahu's response.
Well, I don't know exactly what the president meant. But if he meant by that, that I'm pursuing private policies against the majority, the wish of the majority of Israelis, and that this is hurting the interests of Israel, then he's wrong on both counts. Number one, these are not my private policies only. They're policies supported by the overwhelming majority of the Israelis. They support the action that we're taking to destroy the remaining terrorist battalions of Hamas. They say that once we destroy the Hamas, the last thing we should do is put in Gaza, in charge of Gaza, the Palestinian Authority that educates its children towards terrorism and pays for terrorism. And they also support my position that says that we should resoundingly reject the attempt to ram down our throats a Palestinian state.
Kate, interesting and forceful response by Netanyahu, respectful of the president, but nonetheless very clear on two points. One, that the policy or the strategy of going into Rafah is something that the vast majority of Israelis support. And two, that at this juncture anyway, they don't support a two-state solution, which would be the Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank, because the Palestinian Authority is not, yes, trustworthy to lead. And when Netanyahu says that, I think he's right. You know, Elliot Kaufman's over in Israel now and has been writing about this, but Benny Gantz, who is the main opponent of Netanyahu politically, but joined a particular war cabinet after October 7th. He supports going into Rafah. Yoav Gallant, the Minister of Defense, he supports going into Rafah, though he and Netanyahu have often been at odds. And the reason is that if they don't go into Rafah and Hamas is allowed to survive there, then Hamas will not be destroyed and Israel will not achieve its main war aim.
Right. I mean, I thought part of what Netanyahu's statement that was so powerful was describing, you know, he has his own red line, that October 7th never happened again. I think the term red line should probably be retired because it's so profoundly associated with Barack Obama's line in Syria, and it was a red line that went unenforced. I think this looks similarly impotent from the president, in addition to being just wrong on the merits on how to treat an ally. He didn't leave it open for shutting off Iron Dome, these missile interceptors that Israel relies on, but he did kind of leave it open a question about what he might do if Israel goes into Rafah. But he surely had to know that Israel is going into Rafah. And so it simply makes him look weak, and it doesn't look as though he has much influence on Israel. I think Elliot's point in his piece today in the journal was dead on, that the administration is trying to make this distinction between the Israeli people and a villain in Netanyahu. And what the misreading is that not only is the Israeli public with Netanyahu, but if they were to come up with somebody else, that person would probably be even more on the right wing of the spectrum than Netanyahu is. So this idea that there's not public support for what Israel wants to do in Rafah, I don't think is credible. And I'd also just add, that makes perfect sense. I mean, Israel has absorbed casualties. It has taken economic damage by having folks out of the economy doing reserve duty. And the idea that they would come this far and allow Hamas to hang out in a stronghold and not eliminate the threat that caused October 7th, I mean, it makes no sense. It would risk, if anything, repeating some of our own mistakes that the U.S. made and not doing enough to finish off the threats in the Middle East before departing. So I think that's clear why Israel is so dead set on going into Rafah.
All right, we're going to take another break. When we come back, we'll talk a little more about the Biden administration dispute with Israel over the war and some of its domestic political implications here in the U.S. when we come back.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast. That is, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot here on Potomac Watch, the podcast of the Wall Street Journal opinion pages, here with Bill McGurn and Kate O'Dell. So one of the things that I think Biden is also sore about here, he doesn't bring it up much, but behind the scenes, you know, the administration has been working very hard, Bill, on trying to get a Saudi-Israel peace deal signed here in the last year, the first term. It would be a foreign policy achievement, join the Abraham Accords. But as the war drags on, this becomes harder to do because the Saudis aren't going to negotiate at all publicly anymore until this Gaza campaign is done. And Biden wants it wrapped up as soon as possible because any treaty he has to present to Congress, which includes certain U.S. security guarantees to the Saudis, as well as some nuclear power guarantees for peaceful purposes, that might also have to be approved by the U.S. Congress. And that gets harder to do the closer you get to an election. So that's behind the scenes here as well. But in my view, the best thing would be for the president, as well as Israel, would be for let Israel finish this war as quickly as possible. You know, if they can do it in a couple of months, 2-3 months, then maybe it still won't be going on by the Democratic convention in August.
Yeah, exactly. All the good guys share the same interests. Get this over as quickly as possible, root out the Hamas leaders, and capture or kill them. There's no substitute for that. If it drags out, it's bad for Israel, bad for the Palestinians caught in the fighting, bad for everyone there except Hamas. They benefit from delay and everything. And again, missed opportunity to point out, why don't we have a ceasefire? It's because Hamas is holding out, right?
Yeah,
not
yeah.
Israel.
Right.
And he didn't point that out. And these are facts everyone knows, especially over in the Middle East, but that he doesn't say. So I think Biden has been very high-handed toward our allies in the region, very soft on Iran, one of our explicit enemies. And I think he's paying a price for that. Who is going to trust him out there to take an extra step or do something they kind of have doubts about? I don't think anyone.
Kate, let's talk about the domestic political implications here. I mean, there's an argument to be made. Some are making it quietly on the Democratic side that, look, this isn't really a fundamental change in administration policy to Israel, which Biden will still support. It's a rhetorical change because he needs to show the Democratic left, as Bill was suggesting earlier, that he really has a deep concern for the humanitarian side here and the legitimate plight of the Palestinians, civilians. So he's trying to kind of maneuver here between his left-wing faction and the main part of his party, which is still very pro-Israel. And so he's giving a lot more rhetoric to the left, but he's given the policy to the pro-Israel side. What do you think of that analysis?
I think it's true, but I think it might be riskier than the president appreciates because he looks unwilling to defend his own policies. And I think that voters do respect a commander-in-chief who goes out and explains why what he's done is correct. And to Bill's point about hearing nothing from him about the hostages, some of which are American citizens, and having those hostages not be a centerpiece of his thinking about Israel and explaining to the public why that merits the U.S. support of Israel's war. I think giving Israel weapons, I mean, so much of what we've been giving Israel are precision bombs that help Israel reduce civilian casualties. We give them GPS guidance on bombs that help them strike within 10 feet of a target as opposed to a much broader range. So I think that he defending U.S. support on the merits, I understand it would be a risk with his left flank. But his risk now is that he simply alienates those two who support Israel because they think he's unwilling to explain why he's made the choices that he's made. So I think that's wrapped up in this two-step he's trying to do, and a real risk of that, that he's not quite considered.
Bill, and there's the wild card here now that the presidential contest is clearly between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. The wild card here is Donald Trump. His comments on this conduct of the war have not been extensive at all. He's basically said that if I were president, it never would have happened, which of course he says about everything that has happened under Biden. But he had his own, Trump did, his own very clear falling out with Netanyahu, even though they got along well while Trump was president. Afterwards, Trump is still very sore because Netanyahu was one of the first foreign leaders to congratulate President Biden on his victory and to reach out and try to, obviously, an act of goodwill. But Trump wanted him to, of course, hold off because he thought that Biden had stolen the election. And that's the kind of personal grievance politics that could affect Trump in his dealings with Netanyahu.
Yeah, I do think, though, Donald Trump reads the polls, you know, very avidly. There is overwhelming support in the U.S. for Israel. And I think what I'm going to lay out is very improbable, but it would really help Joe Biden. So for Joe Biden to back up his initial rhetoric with a very strong stance on Israel, to say, if you need weapons, we got your back. We're going to defend you, what you do. To make the case, you know, laying out who's responsible for these deaths of civilians, it'd be good for him because, one, it'd be supporting a cause. I think it's 80% in one poll, vast majority of American people, not the protesters at Columbia or in the other universities support, but the actual voters support. So that'd be one thing. And also his real problem underneath all the stuff in foreign affairs is a perception that he's weakling. You know, the loss of Afghanistan is still a big thing for people. And you can blame Republicans for holding up aid, but he hasn't got it through. You know, for all his expertise in Congress, he hasn't done it. When I was at the White House with Bush, we got a lot of aid packages for Iraq through, even though it was Democratic majority where people were against it. So I think if Biden took a very strong Israel stance that coincided with his initial rhetoric, it would help him on those two fronts. But as you say, I think he's just too worried about the demonstrations, all these people blocking airports, in fact, blocking the White House at one point. And I think he's had several letters from campaign staff, from inside his administration. So I think that looms largest for him.
Well, he probably should try to shut that down, certainly from inside the administration, and get this war over as rapidly as possible would be in everybody's best interest. All right, Bill, Kate, thank you both. And thank you all for listening. We are here every day on Potomac Watch. And so we'll hope to have you here tomorrow, as usual. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.